This is Stories of Win, where we showcase amazing women in neuroscience. We chat with them about their research, their unique journeys through academia, and what drives their passion for studying the brain. Here is one of their stories.
I'm Meenakshi from Stories of Win, and I'm so excited to be here today with Dr. Maria Geffen, who is a professor in the departments of otolaryngology, neuroscience, and neurology at the University of Pennsylvania. Thank you so much for being here with us.
Of course, my pleasure.
So to start things off, we generally like to ask, how did you first become interested in studying the brain? When did you discover your passion for science and research?
I've always been interested in studying the brain, I think starting in middle school. So I initially, in high school, got interested in psychology. And so I actually worked in a psychology lab over the summer when I was in high school. And then ever since, pretty much every summer, I would work in a lab. And then in college, I started first studying psychology. But I also really liked math and computer science. And so that's when I discovered neuroscience.
Great. So for your undergrad, did you already know you wanted to do neuroscience? Or were you, what was your major? Were you trying to keep a broader focus at that point?
Yeah, so I was actually, I first started out as a psychology major. But since I was also taking quantitative classes, I got interested in working with John Hopfeld, who was at Princeton. And he's really one of the founders of computational neuroscience. And he was in the molecular biology department. So then I switched to molecular biology major with a biophysics minor.
Great. And you then did your PhD in the biophysics program at Harvard. So how was your graduate school experience and who did you work with?
Yeah, so I got very lucky. I loved graduate school. And the reason why I chose the biophysics program is that it has very few constraints. So it brings people across different fields within biology. And so as long as it's quantitative, as long as you can write an equation to explain what you're studying, you know, that's considered biophysics. So as an undergrad, actually, I was working on the rat whisker system, the vibrissa system of rats. And with John Hopfeld, we came up with kind of a hypothesis that was really interesting of how the whiskers worked. And if you look at the rat's snout, you can see that there are rows of whiskers, and the whiskers in different rows have different lengths. So we started thinking about their mechanical properties, so their mechanoelastic properties, and we realized that they actually have different resonance frequencies. And so then we asked the question, does the brain actually use this information from the different resonance of the whiskers? When I started looking into the literature in the whisker field, I realized that actually that's something that's been overlooked for decades, because in order to get more data from the same electrophysiological recordings, the investigators would trim the whiskers to the same length. And so all the whiskers would then have the same resonance frequency. So there was no way to check to test this idea based on previous studies. And so when I got to graduate school, I met Chris Moore, who was a professor, an assistant professor. He was just starting. And he was very interested in studying the whisker system. And he got very interested in this idea. And together with another graduate student in the biophysics program, Mark Anderman, we actually measured the brain responses to these whiskers when we drove them at different resonant frequencies to test whether there is resonant tuning in the brain. And that was actually a really exciting discovery that kind of got me hooked. And I just really loved computational neuroscience. I love the idea that you could write an equation down and then really test whether the brain uses this information in a very quantitative way.
That's very interesting, and especially that you could take a hypothesis that you kind of like developed during your undergrad and kind of follow up and study that during your graduate work as well. And then you completed your PhD in the lab of Marcus Meister at Harvard University. So how was that transition, and what were some of your discoveries in his lab?
Yeah, so... I found Marcus Meister's lab because he was also kind of, he did the kind of research that I loved where you combine quantitative measurements with biology. And there we studied visual processing in the retina. And the reason why we use the retina is that you can scoop the retina out of the eye of an animal and put it in a dish, and it will still be basically functioning the same way as it was functioning in the eye. So you can do all kinds of measurements, but you have a lot of access to all the neurons. And we perform multi-electrode recordings from neuronal populations from ganglion cells, which are the output cells of the retina. And we were interested in what happens during saccadic movements. So we move our eyes several times per second. And when we move our eyes, the entire visual field actually shifts on the retina. So our brain actually compensates for that. And we ask, well, how does the retina participate in that compensation? We found a population of cells that actually shifted their response functions from being off type to on type, which allowed them to more readily detect these shifts in visual scenes. So that was my work in the Meister lab.
Great. And so was this in an awake animal, that is, where you're showing a moving?
Well, no, this was in isolated retinas.
I see.
So we could take the retinas out of the eye. Yeah.
I see. And then you can still show like a moving visual field and see the change.
That's right.
That's amazing. And so did you have like crucial moments in graduate school that particularly inspired you to continue down the academic path?
Yeah, I had lots of really kind of transformative experiences. The first one was when I went to, actually just before I started graduate school, I went to summer school in computational neuroscience at Woods Hole. And it was 3 or 4 weeks that we spent with, you know, 20 or 30 other graduate students and postdocs, learning about computational neuroscience, meeting all the professors in the field, and doing independent projects and then presenting them. And it was a really it was a really great experience for me. Some other experiences are probably going to the computational and systems neuroscience meeting. I went to one of the first ones, and it was really exciting to meet researchers who were interested in similar questions.
That definitely sounds very inspiring. And it's also really nice how like your interests in just math and, quantitative things converged nicely with your just like curiosity about different biological phenomena and like things happening and how the brain codes for different sensations. So after your PhD, you were a fellow at the Center for Physics and Biology at Rockefeller University. How was this transition? How did you choose your postdoc mentor and the research topic you wanted to work on?
So that was a really unique opportunity. So Rockefeller University has the Center for Physics and Biology that brings together several research labs. And they have a fellow program, and the fellow can come and is not assigned to a single lab, but can really collaborate across different laboratories. I mainly worked with Professor Marcelo Magnesco, and our research focused on the analysis of natural sounds. So we were very interested in understanding the kind of fractal properties of sounds.
That sounds very interesting. So can you elaborate a bit more on what you mean about like fractal properties of sounds?
Yeah, so there is something that we, so I started thinking in about audition because I got very interested in auditory processing. And I also wanted to shift my research from studying kind of peripheral coding to more central coding. So trying to understand the actual brain mechanisms for perception and behavior. And so I was interested in understanding how neurons in the auditory system encode information about complex auditory scenes. And so with Marcelo Magnesco, we developed some methods for analyzing natural sounds and trying to generate a whole family of different types of sounds. And then we did the psychophysical study to see how people perceive these sounds. But we ultimately wanted to use these sounds to measure the response properties of neurons in the brain.
And the fractal property you were referring to is just something inherent to natural sounds in general?
Yeah, so that's, you know, true for visual, natural visual images, and it's also true for natural sounds. So as you scale, as you try to look at sounds at different scales, there is statistical similarities across those scales.
That makes sense. So by this point, you had already covered kind of the full suite of sensory systems, all the way from somatosensory to visual, olfactory, and even the auditory system. So how was that scientific journey? And I'm just curious, kind of like, what lessons did you take away from studying each of these sensory systems? Was it like the commonalities that blew your mind, or was it more like the differences and what you can kind of study, differently in each sensory system?
That's a really interesting question. So I feel like I've always asked the same question throughout my research, which is, what are the computational principles the brain uses for perception? And so in a way, across different sensory modalities, there were very similar principles that we would discover. But also there were, specific properties. And those were actually connected to the way those senses present in the natural world. So something that's really at the core of my research is this idea of efficient coding. So the efficient coding hypothesis postulates that the brain has evolved to represent the world around us in an efficient fashion. Presumably, we have limited resources, the brain, that we don't want to use too much energy in processing and representing the world around us. The brain also wants, we don't want to get overwhelmed, right? We don't want the information that's not important. And at the same time, we want to leave room for unexpected events, because those might signal danger or food source or something interesting, approaching us. And so the brain tries to kind of keep this balance between being able to encode important stimuli, but also leaving room for being sensitive to unexpected sounds or, other visual or olfactory stimuli.
Is there a reason you particularly just wanted to move on to a different sensory modality during like different phases of your career? Was it just like curiosity, or are certain things like easier to study or access in different modalities?
Well, I think the auditory system is great to study in mice because they actually use sounds to communicate with each other. And so it's a very it's a great modality to study, So I think in every case, I guess I was interested more in the underlying questions rather than, you know, being necessarily interested in audition because, you know, because of the importance of the auditory system and relative to other systems.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
For sure. So you're now a full professor at the University of Pennsylvania, and you've been directing the Laboratory for Auditory Coding since 2010. And your lab studies a wide variety of topics, including auditory learning and memory, perception of complex sounds, and dissection of different auditory microcircuits. Could you tell us a little bit about your lab's like current research interest and some of the recent discoveries from your lab?
Sure, yeah. One recent paper that I'm particularly proud of actually deals with this efficient coding question that I talked to you about. And in a way, we did the study that we wanted to do, you know, that I wanted to do my whole career, which is connect efficient, the principles of efficient coding at the neuronal level to perception. And so in this study, we showed that the efficient coding that actually takes place in the auditory cortex translates into perceptual, into perception and behavior. And the way we did that is we trained mice on a really clever task where, and this is my grad student at the time, Chris Angeloni, developed this task and came up with this idea. And so the idea behind the task is that when we shift the environment that we're in, say we go into a quiet lecture hall from the loud outdoors, the statistics of sounds that we hear shift. And as the statistics of sounds change, so outdoors, there is a wider range of loudness levels that we perceive, whereas indoors, there is a much smaller range. The range of sounds we call contrast. And so we go from high contrast to low contrast environment. And so as that distribution of loudness changes, neurons throughout the auditory system adapt their responses so that they can optimally encode this distribution of sounds. That means that when we're outdoors, or let's say when we're at the rock concert, our neurons are quite not so sensitive to small changes in sounds, but are responsive at both very high and very low volumes of sounds. Whereas when we're indoors in a lecture hall, or let's imagine we're at a classical concert, our auditory system is actually sensitive to much smaller differences in loudness. So it's kind of matches the sweet spot for its sensitivity to what is happening in the environment. But that transition takes a little bit of time. In the case of mice, it takes a few hundreds of milliseconds. And we can measure the responses from neurons in the brain and track those hundreds of milliseconds of what we call adaptation. So it's called gain adaptation to or contrast adaptation. Now, this adaptation is actually asymmetrical. When the sounds shift from loud to quiet, it actually takes a little bit longer for the auditory system to adapt than during the opposite transition. And the reason for that is that it takes longer to detect statistical outliers for our brain. When we go outdoors and it gets very loud, it gets loud very fast. Whereas when we go inside and it's quiet, it takes a little while to register the full statistical range. And so we train mice on the task where we present, they had to detect sounds in different noise backgrounds. Very much like imagine talking to somebody at a bar or at a rock concert. And but we would shift those backgrounds from high contrast to low contrast and vice versa. we also recorded at the same time the activity in their brains. And what we found is that this differential adaptation timescales that we observed in the brain and that we could also predict theoretically also manifested themselves perceptually. And when we inactivated the auditory cortex, so the key region for contrast adaptation in the brain, the ability of mice to detect the sounds and noise actually went away. So we were able to link the efficient coding in the form of contrast adaptation in the brain to perception and behavior.
Well, that is super fascinating and really well explained. So now going forward, like, what do you see as some of like the more big open questions in the field, and how does your lab want to tackle that?
So we're working on several topics. One of the topics is the neuronal mechanisms for auditory perception under uncertainty. So when we can't quite hear the sound that's presented to us, we use other cues to disambiguate that sound. Imagine if you're talking to somebody in a bar, you would be using cues from their lip movements to help you interpret what they said. You can also rely on what you know about how they talk and what they were just, and make predictions for what they are about to say. So we have a research program investigating the brain mechanisms for that. We're also really interested in representation of sound melodies, so sequences of sounds and how the brain makes prediction about what kinds of sounds it expects to come next. We're also interested in cross-modal integration. So where I actually am excited about that because we're trying to put together an understanding of how information across all modalities comes together in the brain. So right now, we're investigating the interactions between auditory and olfactory and auditory and sensory systems. We actually recently had a paper on audiovisual integration. So definitely, I'm using kind of what I have learned through my years of working in other sensory modalities to develop these projects. And then we're also starting a research program on trying to understand the neuronal mechanisms for sensitivity to sounds associated with autism spectrum disorders. So there are many models, genetic models for autism, we're trying to understand whether some of the brain microcircuits that we discover that are responsible for hearing noise or hearing detecting irregularities in sounds are actually disrupted with autism.
That sounds like a really important and a very interesting list of topics that your lab is focusing on. Like you also mentioned, like you're bringing together what you've learned from different modalities and really synthesizing things together, which is really awesome. And just to go back and touch a little bit more about like also like different subcortical and cortical microcircuits that you're studying, and like something that you mentioned that these things are probably a lot of the mechanisms and behind the perception of different complex auditory stimuli you're studying are probably being encoded at multiple levels and like in both the auditory and like similarly in the visual system. So how do you study that, and how do you decide on like which microcircuits and which circuits are responsible and for some of these like very interesting perceptual phenomena that you study?
So, I mean, there may be different ways to address that. In my lab, we mainly focus on the auditory cortex, the inferior colliculus, and the auditory thalamus. Those are kind of the key regions in the central auditory pathway. We don't so much study peripheral auditory system, but we would be doing that, you know, in collaboration with other labs if that were of interest to our projects. Yeah.
For something like efficient coding or like contrast adaptation, is there something that would happen at the peripheral level as well in the auditory system?
Oh, for sure. And there is also massive feedback going to the cochlea from the auditory cortex. So all these mechanisms backpropagate to peripheral system.
There's so much known in sensory neuroscience, but also it's such a complicated system with like so many nodes and feedback and kind of processing happening at so many stages, which is like very shared and very interesting. Okay, so now kind of talking about like your whole last decade as a principal investigator, what has just been the most like rewarding thing and the most challenging thing as a PI of a lab?
Well, I think that for me, mentoring students has been the most rewarding. And probably most people will say that's also the most challenging part of this. I think that figuring out how to give somebody space to grow and to be creative while also training them and guiding them through the process is both challenging and rewarding. I think that I've always tried to make sure that we have a very inclusive and very collaborative atmosphere in the lab, and that there is kind of positive energy that I get from my interactions with the students and postdocs are just really, really motivating force for me.
For sure. And that dovetails really well with what I wanted to touch upon next, which is like how your own mentors have influenced and shaped your vision for mentoring and what kind of a mentor you want to be.
That's a really good question. So I think that I've learned a lot, both what to do and what not to do from my former mentors. I think that in all cases, I had very hands-off mentors who gave me a lot of room to work and freedom. And on the one hand, that was really great because I could explore many topics. On the other hand, I had a lot of data that never saw the light of day and never got published or brought to fruition. So I'm trying to kind of do both. You know, I'm trying to make sure my students and postdocs stay productive while also not micromanaging them.
That sounds really nice. And if you were to go back in time, what advice would you give yourself during graduate school or postdoc?
Well, I think something that I tell other postdocs or, you know, starting faculty members is that what's really important is to understand that you are going to be successful in the end, right? And so there are many time points when it gets tough and you start doubting yourself and you start thinking, is this worth it? Or, you know, am I good enough? And in a way, it doesn't necessarily help either way. Like whether or not you stay in academia or not, it doesn't necessarily help to have negative thoughts. So I think a really important thing is to kind of figure out how to believe that you are going to be successful and you're here. Remember that you're here for the science and not the politics, and kind of be able to chart your own course.
That's beautiful advice. How has I guess your identity, and especially as a woman in neuroscience, shaped your experience so far?
Yeah, so I mean, it's complicated because in there are subfields in neuroscience where, you know, women are at parity, but in my field in computational and systems neuroscience, you know, we started out with something like 14% of women, and now we're at something like 26%. So, and in a way, that's kind of an, at every stage, like at every academic rank, the percentage goes down. And so it is, I've had to learn how to often be the only woman in the room and still make my voice heard, and not be intimidated, and kind of participate on equal footing in discussions. That's not something that was easy for me.
Is there a particular advice that you have for listeners who might feel like at sometimes the only like women in the room, or just like difficult to voice their opinion sometimes?
I mean, there are, like, I think it's really important to understand that that is uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable for women, or it's uncomfortable people from different minority backgrounds. It's uncomfortable to be the only one of a kind in the room, and to be talked over. And so I think just understanding that and not feeling guilty for that, you know, but just kind of understanding that you kind of have to be assertive and you have to take the seat at the table. And there are many manuals on that and books that are being written. And I think that might help. I personally have never had time to read a book like that, but I've heard some talks and I've heard other kind of advice along those lines. And I think it's mostly just internalizing that it's not okay. Like, it shouldn't be that way. You should not be the only person in the room or in the minority. It should be at parity. That's an important component to kind of moving forward.
For sure. It's been amazing to capture all the highlights of your trajectory. And I mean, I'm sure there were also a lot of like hurdles and challenges along the way. And we've been touching upon a few of those. But is there anything that was like particularly challenging to you during your scientific career? And like, how did you overcome that? And what was your source of inspiration during such moments?
So I think the most challenging part was starting my own lab, and especially the first 3 years. I had many grants not discussed. I had very unfair reviews. And I think it was really tough because throughout my training, I actually, you know, trained in very elite labs. And the tone of the reviews that I would get when I became the principal investigator was very different from the tone of the reviews that, you know, I had on my publications with my mentors. So that was kind of my first, like, very shocking experience. I think it really opened my eyes to how biased our system was, because my research did not change. My papers did not really change. They were no worse or better than my PhD or postdoc papers, but the reviews were very, very different, and sometimes aggressive, and sometimes demeaning, and a lot of, you know, girls can't do math kind of thing. And that's really hard. It's hard when you start in your lab and you need to get your grants. You need to make sure the grad students that you have, that you can afford to keep them. It's very stressful. And that's something that really kind of changed with me just, I think, asserting my voice, going to conferences, organizing conferences, kind of establishing my presence in the field, whether, let's just say, the that my presence was wanted or not. Over time, things became easier.
Definitely. And thanks for sharing that. It's really sad to hear, but at the same time, like seeing people like you come out of this so successfully and like managing these challenges, I'm sure is a source of inspiration to all of us. And just on a more broader level, are there like other changes you wish to see in academia?
Well, there are lots of changes that I would like to see. So, I mean, we are still in a very I don't even know where to start. Like, we can start with the peer review system. Right now, we have a lot of problem with publishing, right? It takes so long to publish. We know that the review system is biased. Numerous studies have shown that. We know that, and yet very few things change. In fact, I don't know why it happened, but over the last few years, it's gotten, the review process has gotten longer and longer. And the reviews that we've been getting have required, you know, additional experiments that take years to complete. So I feel like that system really has to get better. And it is great that we have BioArchive, and that in particular that has been included in PubMed searches. I've just been like thrilled about that. And so I think the push towards open science has been very positive, but you know, we have to complete it. And so tied into that is the system for promotion, for which it still remains, and hiring, for which it still remains very important, you know, what journal you publish in. That's something that has been shown to be biased, a biased measure of... So I think that's a big problem.
For sure. Thank you so much for touching upon some of these like very important topics. And it reminds me of like an advice that you just gave a few minutes ago, which sometimes we just have to still just focus on the science and not think about the politics and keep going. And I do hope to see some of these, you know, like changes, some of these things changing in the near future, just in making academia a better place. And to just end on a lighter note, tell us more about maybe some of your favorite hobbies or activities that you like to do outside the lab to feel more relaxed and refreshed.
Well, I'm a big fan of exercising. So I love doing yoga and running and spending time outdoors. Actually just went camping a couple weekends ago with my two boys, and it was really fun experience in the fall. So like a fun thing we did this summer as a family, we drove across the country. So we drove all the way to San Diego, spent a week in San Diego, and then drove back, stopping in all the national parks. So I guess I just love exploring.
That sounds really nice. What would you be doing if you were not a neuroscientist?
There are lots of things that I love. I love arts and music. I actually was, as an undergrad, I did a minor in visual studies, so I worked on the documentary films. So I think that's also something that I could see myself doing.
Documentary sounds really cool. Thank you so much, Maria. Thanks for your time and for sharing your inspiring story with us. It's been such a pleasure chatting with you.
Good to talk to you, Meenakshi.